Mission Hills, and 4th of July coming up. It's weird when the 4th of July is on Wednesday, right? Because, like, which exactly is 4th of July? We sort of picked this one arbitrarily. How many of you, like, have the next couple of days off leading up to 4th of July? Interesting. How many of you have the days after the 4th of July off? Yeah, it's just kind of in the middle. They probably should have just given us, like, a 10-day break. We should make that a national deal, right? Yeah. Well, I have no power anywhere, just so you know. I cannot make that happen, but I wish it upon you, okay? I'm really glad you're here today. We're going to be taking a look at something in the book of Daniel that I think is really important for us to deal with, and yet I think it's a subject that we don't really deal with all that much, especially in America. We're going to be taking a look at what I think is one of the most dangerous things that you and I will ever face. And it's not dangerous because it's more evil or necessarily more destructive than anything else. It's dangerous because it operates without us being aware that it's happening. It's what I'm going to call a seductive danger. And by seductive, I just mean it's the ability to lead us to a place that we don't want to be without realizing that's where we're headed. Something that's seductive gets us to that place where we kind of look around and go, how did I get here? If somebody had told you that's where you're headed, you'd have said, no, I don't want to go there. I have no interest in going there. I'm not going to go there. But something that's seductive kind of gets us moving in that direction and leads us to a place that we end up kind of going, how did I get here? This is not what I want. This is not what I thought I was headed for. And so we're going to talk today about what I call a seductive danger. And then the danger I'm talking about is the danger of success. Which is an interesting thing to say because honestly, we live in a culture that worships success. And the idea that success could be dangerous is not something that we naturally come to. And understand, I'm not saying that success is bad. It's not. In fact, God often gives success. But success has the ability to seduce us into some things that if we're not aware of it, can take us to a place where we go, I had no intention of ever being here. So why don't you go ahead and grab your Bible and make your way to Daniel chapter 11. We're going to be picking up in verse 2. Daniel 11:1 is actually part of the previous chapter, so we dealt with it last weekend. And today we're going to pick up with the conversation that Daniel's having with an angel. The angel has come to give Daniel an interpretation of a vision that he's been given, and this is what the angel says, verse 2. Now then, I tell you the truth. Three more kings will arise in Persia, and then a fourth, who will be far richer than all of the others. And when he has gained power by his wealth, he will stir up everyone against the king of Greece. Basically, what the angel is saying is, hey, Daniel, I know you're serving under a Persian king. His name is Cyrus. We know from Daniel 10:1 that was who Daniel was kind of acting as an advisor to. And what the angel says is, hey, there's going to be several more Persian kings before the Persian Empire comes to pass. But he says something kind of interesting. He says, and then there will be a fourth who will be far richer than all the others. Like, why say that? And the answer is because riches is a sign of success. I mean, for the Persian Empire, their riches, their wealth, was a visible demonstration of their success in battle. They had gained their wealth by attacking other people, conquering them, and taking all their stuff. And so at the height of its empire, the Persian Empire and the last king, he was just incredibly rich. Really, it was to say he's incredibly successful. And something happens when you're successful, and that is people start listening to you. When he's gained power by his wealth. See, success leads to influence. And influence causes a couple of different things to happen. One of them is when we hear people listening to us, we start to think we have something worth saying, which is kind of an interesting thing. And that's the celebrity phenomenon, right? Like, there's all kinds of celebrities right now who are weighing in on political issues and ethical issues, and you're like, who are you again? Oh, that's right, you did that movie. Or you're on that reality TV show. But see, they have success, and with success comes influence. And when we have people listening to us, we start to feel like, I have something to say. And then honestly, when you see people who are successful, there's this natural human tendency to go, well, they must have something to say, right? How else would they have gotten to this point? But here's something we have to recognize. People tend to confuse success with wisdom. It's a natural human tendency. We confuse success with wisdom, but they're really not the same thing at all. In this particular case, because of their great success, other people, other nations, and people are listening to this Persian king, and what he decides to do with his influence is to stir up trouble against the king of Greece, which turns out to have been a terrible, terrible mistake. Verse 3 says this, and then a mighty king will arise who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. This is a description, even though it's several hundred years in advance. What Daniel is saying is he's singing the rise of a man named Alexander the Great, the Greek king. And so basically what happened is this. Persia kind of looked around and they saw this little nation of Greece. It wasn't a big deal at the time. And this something about them sort of offended the Persian king. And so because of his success, people listened to him. He used his success to say, hey, we should like show that guy a lesson. And they poked him. It's a little bit, it reminds me a little bit of the crocodile hunter. You guys remember the crocodile hunter? Like, I can't believe he lasted as long as he did. Because every episode he's like, oh, this is a really dangerous thing. I'm going to poke it with a stick. Like, why? That's basically what happened here, okay? They're like, I'm going to poke this thing. Yeah, so they poke the bear, and the problem when you poke a bear is sometimes the bear wakes up, and he comes after you, and that's exactly what happened. Alexander, he attacked not only Persia and destroyed the Persian Empire, but he really conquered all of the known world in just 3 to 4 years. It was an incredible military feat. And we begin to see a pattern here, because what happened is the Persian Empire was successful, and success led to arrogance. And that arrogance led to destruction. Now Alexander arises, and we begin to see the same kind of pattern. He will rule with great power. That's another sign of success. And he will do as he pleases, which is Bible talk for arrogance. He'll do whatever he wants. He won't feel like he needs advice. He won't feel like anybody can slow him down or stop, because why would I listen to you? I'm the success. See, that's arrogance. And so with the Persians, we saw that success led to arrogance and arrogance to destruction. Now we see success lead to arrogance, and the question is that also going to lead to destruction? Verse 4. After he is arisen, his empire will be broken up and parceled out to the four winds of heaven. It will not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others. Yeah, it led to destruction. In fact, this first phrase, after he has arisen, can also be translated as soon as he had arisen. The point is, kind of at the moment that he reached the top of the ladder, the pinnacle of his success, he died. And he died of some fever. And he died very young, and it meant that he didn't have any heirs that were ready to take the throne. And so his kingdom kind of fell apart, and his generals began to fight over it. And eventually, four generals kind of emerge as the dominant powers. That's the four winds of heaven that Daniel is foreseeing, his kingdom parcel out in the four winds of heaven. It did not go to his descendants. He didn't have them. And it did not have the power he exercised. His kingdom is destroyed because his empire is uprooted. So we see this pattern. I mean, already just in the first couple of sentences of this chapter, we see this pattern emerging. Success leads to arrogance and arrogance to destruction. It happened for the Persians. For Alexander, success led to arrogance and arrogance to destruction. And what we're going to see as we continue through this chapter is that that pattern emerges over and over and over again. It's almost a drumbeat that God just keeps hitting, so much so that you're like, we got it. But God's going to go, no, I don't know that you do. Let me show you again. Okay, I get it. Success, arrogance. No, I'm not sure that you do. And he hits it again and again and again. Now, what we're going to see through the rest of this chapter is it's prophecy. Daniel was given this hundreds of years before the events took place. What we're going to mostly see is a series of descriptions of things that would happen between the remnants of Alexander the Great's empire. Eventually, you had basically two kingdoms, the kingdom of the north and the kingdom of the south, and they were constantly fighting and making treaties and breaking them, and all kinds of things were happening. And all the things that he talks about came to be fulfilled in very precise ways. And we could easily spend all day today and then the next couple weekends talking about all the historical predictions and the fulfillment. But I don't think that's what we're supposed to focus on. Rather than focusing on the precision of the predictions, I think what we're supposed to focus on is this pattern. Success to arrogance, arrogance to destruction. So as we read through it, just look for those drumbeats. Listen for them. Verse 5. The king of the south will become strong, that's success. But one of his commanders will become even stronger than he and will rule his own kingdom with great power, that's more success. After some years, they will become allies. The daughter of the king of the south will go to the king of the north to make an alliance, but she will not retain her power, destruction. And he and his power will not last, destruction. In those days, she will be betrayed, together with her royal escort and her father, the one who supported her, destruction. One from her family line will arise to take her place. He will attack the forces of the king of the north and enter his fortress. He will fight against them and be victorious, success. He will also seize their gods, their metal images and their valuable articles of silver and gold and carry them off to Egypt. That's arrogance. I mean, not only did he defeat the army, but he took their religious symbols and he took them back home and he put them on display to say, look, I'm even more powerful than their gods. That's arrogance. For some years, he will leave the king of the north alone, and then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but he'll retreat to his own country. His sons will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. That's success. Then the king of the south will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north, who will raise a large army, but it will be defeated, destruction. When the army is carried off, the king of the south will be filled with pride, that's arrogance, and he will slaughter many thousands, yet he will not remain triumphant, destruction. For the king of the north will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years, he will advance with a huge army fully equipped. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south. Those who are violent among your own people will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. And then the king of the north will come and build siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. The forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases. That's what? That's arrogance. No one will be able to stand against him. That's success. He will establish himself in the beautiful land, that's Israel, and will have the power to destroy it. He will determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south. And he will give him a daughter in marriage in order to overthrow the kingdom, but his plans will not succeed or help him, destruction. Then he will turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them, but a commander will put an end to his insolence, that's arrogance. He will turn his insolence, his arrogance back on him. And after this, he will turn back toward the fortresses of his own country, but he will stumble and fail and be seen no more. Destruction. His successor will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. That's an interesting statement. He'll have to send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. Not to build better roads for the people, not to raise an army, not to fight battles, but to maintain the splendor. In other words, to maintain the appearance of success. Right? Here's an interesting truth. Maintaining the appearance of success is expensive, right? Maybe you've known somebody that, like, they just seem to spend money left and right, and what they're really doing is they're trying to make themselves look successful with the things they have and the kinds of vacations they take and that sort of a thing, right? Maintaining the appearance of success is incredibly expensive. That's one of the reasons why success can be such a seductive thing. Because it leads us into making decisions which actually take us off track of the very thing that might have made us successful in the first place. Because we just have to kind of maintain that appearance. I think this happens even in the church world. A couple of months ago, I was with a group of pastors back east. And I was hearing from, he was an executive pastor. And he was kind of new to a church. And he was just sharing some frustrations with where the church was. And as he began to unpack it, I couldn't believe this story. I'm not even going to tell you what part of the country because I don't know why I'm trying to find this church. But it was a church that experienced a lot of success in years past. They were the largest church in the area. They're sort of the premium. Everybody looked at them. They had a great facility that they built. And everybody kind of went, yeah, I mean, they're killing it. They're awesome. This is fantastic. And that was 10 years ago. And then they kind of started into a decline. And they declined. I think that he said they were about a third of the size they had been when they'd built that building. And he'd only been there for a few months, but he said, our congregation just took a vote. They said, what are we going to do? We're no longer as successful a church as we were. And so they voted as a congregation to spend, I think he said, $80 million renovating their building. I know. And my first reaction is, you had $80 million. You, like, where'd you get access to that kind of cash? And the second, you're going to spend it to renovate. It's not because they're out of space. It's not because they were in overflow. It was because they wanted to maintain that appearance of being the preeminent successful church in the area. And I go, man, that's exactly what's happening here. Maintaining the appearance of success is incredibly expensive, whether that's a church or whether it's a country or even in our own lives, making sure everybody knows that we're successful and holding on to that, well, that can lead us down a road that we don't want to come to the end of. In a few years, however, it says, he will be destroyed. Yet not in anger in battle. He will be succeeded by a contemptible person who has not been given the honor of royalty. He will invade the kingdom when its people feel secure, and he will seize it through intrigue. If you're interested in where we are in the historical timeline, what Daniel is predicting a couple hundred years in advance is the rise of a man that we've talked about a bit before in the last few weeks. His name was Antiochus IV. He wasn't actually the rightful heir. He was a contemptible person. Everybody in the ancient world, Jewish people as well as other races, talk about this man with absolutely nothing but contempt. They hated this man. He had not been given the honor of royalty. He wasn't in line for the throne. His nephew was, but through intrigue, through political maneuvers, he managed to get his nephew kicked off, and he became the king. Daniel's seeing all this in advance. Verse 22. And then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him. That's success. And a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. In 171 BC, Antiochus plotted for the murder of the Jewish high priest, Onias. And I think we can probably all agree that that's arrogant, right? I mean, it's not only you attack a country, but you murder a high priest. That's a sign of contempt against their God. It's arrogance. Verse 23, and after coming to an agreement with him, he will act deceitfully, and with only a few people, he will rise to power. When the richest provinces feel secure, he will invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers nor his forefathers did. He'll be successful. He will distribute plunder, loot, and wealth among his followers. And here we begin to see another one of the dangers of success. When other people are experiencing it, see, they have the resources to reward us for loyalty. And so there's a draw for us to get behind them, to be loyal to them, because maybe they'll reward us. He will plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. You see the hint there that his success is short-lived. His destruction is inevitable. Verse 25, with a large army, he will stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south. The king of the south will wage war with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions will try to destroy him. His army will be swept away and many will fall in battle. Antiochus won tremendous battles. The two kings, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and they will lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. And in the midst of all this sort of back and forth and this chaos and these plots, and honestly, it feels a little bit like a soap opera, right? Like a soap opera played out over several hundred years over on an international scale. Well, God says in the midst of all of that, there's this little reminder that the end's going to come, but at the appointed time, that there's a countdown clock running, that there's a timer. And it's a reminder that God is in control even when it feels like he isn't. God's in control even when it doesn't feel like he is. What God says to his people at this point is, don't be fooled. Don't give up hope. I know it looks like the success of these people is threatening your well-being, and it seems to even to be threatening my sovereignty, but it's not true. I'm watching the clock. This is all under my control. Verse 28, the king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, success, but his heart will be set against the holy covenant. He'll come against the people of God. That's arrogance. He will take action against it and then return to his own country. Interesting historical note. What happened was Antiochus attempted to take Egypt. He didn't quite succeed. There were some negotiations and he left. And on his way home, he came through Israel and he came near to Jerusalem and he heard that there was a party going on in Jerusalem. And when he asked what they were celebrating, what he heard was they were celebrating the fact that Antiochus was dead. A rumor had spread that he had died down in Egypt, and so they threw a big party to celebrate it. So basically, he got there to his own funeral celebration. He was not happy. His response is not what we would call measured or reasonable. He slaughtered thousands of people in Jerusalem. That's what it means that he took action against it. And there's arrogance there. Verse 29, now at the appointed time, he will invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different than what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands will oppose him and he will lose heart. This is a reference to the Roman armies, that some Roman generals actually brought some ships in and stopped him on his way south. This is really the first time we'd seen Rome kind of interfering in this part of the world. He wasn't sure what to do about him, so he turned around and he went home. Then he will turn back and he will vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. He got back to Jerusalem and he remembered the party they threw last time. And like a petulant child, he killed hundreds, if not thousands more. But then you have this interesting statement. He will return and show favor to those who forsake the Holy Covenant. Something different happened this time. On his way back, he remembered the people that had opposed him and celebrated his death. And so he began to attack them again. But this time he encountered another very different group of people from Jerusalem. He had a group of people who kind of met him and went, hey, we're on your side. We're totally Team Antiochus. Don't come after us. We're with you. And the way that it's phrased is they had to forsake the Holy Covenant. In other words, to support Antiochus, what they had to do was they had to break the law of Moses. They had to basically renounce their faith in God to get behind Antiochus. And the question you have to ask at that point is, what would lead them to do that? And the answer is success. They saw Antiochus' success. In spite of some minor setbacks, he was incredibly successful. He was incredibly powerful. He was incredibly wealthy. And the natural tendency is to go, how can I oppose somebody like that? I'm not stupid. I don't want to commit suicide, so I need to get behind him. I need to join that team. And here we begin to see another side to the power of success, the seductive power of success. See, our success, when we experience success, our success tempts us to arrogance. But others' success tempts us to compromise. To go, huh, I think she's going to be the next CEO. I think she's going all the way, so I need to get on her good side. And you know what? What she's asking me to do, it's not really, 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 really wrong. It's just like kind of, sort of really wrong. So maybe if I do this thing, she'll know that, you know, I'm on our team. And so what happens is we make these little steps of compromise. Because we see where this person's going. We don't want to be in front of them because we don't get steamrolled over. And really, we want to be seen to be supportive because they're going to get to a place where maybe they can return the favor. Or at the very least, I don't earn their anger and their wrath. So we make these compromises to get behind them, and that's what's happening here. They've forsaken their faith in order to support success. Verse 31 says, his armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and will abolish the daily sacrifice. And then they will set up the abomination that causes desolation. Antiochus forbid the daily sacrifices in the temple. And beyond that, he put up an altar to the Greek god Zeus in the temple grounds, which rendered the ground unconsecrated. So it couldn't be used for sacrifices, even if Antiochus had allowed it. But he wasn't allowing it, and there were Jewish people that were enforcing it. They were enforcing his new rules and his laws, and honestly, his religion, because they had forsaken the covenant. Verse 32 says, with flattery, he will corrupt those who have violated the covenant. Those people who said, we're Team Antiochus, we're going to get behind you. We're not stupid. We see where the success train is headed. We want to be on board. With flattery, he continued to corrupt them because that one little step turns into another step and another step. And pretty soon, you're in a place that you would never have dreamed of. If anybody had come to these Jewish people and said, hey, in a couple of months, you will have abandoned your faith, you will have compromised your principles, and you will become a traitor to your own country, and you'll be supporting a foreign dictator against your own people, they would have looked at you and gone, there's not a chance, I'm not doing that. And yet that's where they are. Because others' success seduces us into this compromise that takes us to a place we never thought we were headed. But there's another group of people here. And it's interesting the way they're described. He says, but the people who know their God will firmly resist him. The people who know their God, and it's interesting, he doesn't say the people who have stronger faith. He doesn't say the people who, you know, have like bigger spines and stronger spines or more guts. He says the people who know their God. And the question that we're supposed to ask at this point is, know what about God? What is it they know about God that allowed them to escape or to resist the seduction of Antiochus' success? Is it possible that what they knew about God was a truth that we've seen time and time again in the book of Daniel, which is that God rebukes arrogance? We've seen it over and over again. God rebukes arrogance. Success leads to arrogance, and God does not let arrogance stand. God rebukes arrogance, and it leads to destruction. I think what these faithful Jewish people knew that allowed them to resist the seduction of his success was, this isn't going to last. We know who God is. We know how he feels about human arrogance. We know what he does with human arrogance. We know that destruction is coming. It's inevitable. It may not be today. It may not be tomorrow. But there is a day coming, and it is inevitable. It is inexorable. It's going to happen. And so they resisted. But not just them. Also, verse 33 says, those who are wise will instruct many. They told other people, don't be fooled. Don't be seduced into this. He's going to come. This train is going to get derailed. It's going off the tracks. It's just a question of a when, and you don't want to be on board that train when that happens. So they instructed many, though for a time they will fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. Refusing to get behind somebody's success can be costly for a time. When they fall, they will receive a little help. And many who are not sincere will join them. At a certain point, those who resisted Antiochus actually managed to achieve a little bit of independence around the precincts in Jerusalem. And as is often the case, when there's a little bit of success, people are like, hey, I'm on board. I'm on your team. And so people joined them, but it says they were not sincere. They didn't believe in their God. They didn't trust in their faith. But they, well, you seem to be succeeding, so I guess we'll get behind you. Because the problem is that people are pretty fickle when it comes to success. Oh, you're successful? I'm with you. Oh, no, this person, I'm with you. And you get this whiplash going on. But that's the seductive power of success. Verse 35, some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined, purified, and made spotless until the time of the end. For it will still come at the appointed time. Again, destruction of the arrogant. It's unavoidable. It's unescapable. The king will do as he pleases. That's arrogance. He will exalt and magnify himself above every god. He will say unheard of things against the God of gods. We talked about this. Antiochus at a certain point renamed himself Antiochus Epiphanes, which means God manifest. So his new name was God is in the house. That's how arrogant the man was. He will be successful until the time of wrath is completed. He will be successful, but it's got an expiration date on it. For what has been determined must take place. He will show no regard for the gods of his ancestors or for the one desired by women. So the Greek gods, he completely ignored. Nor he will regard any god, but he will exalt himself above them all. Instead of them, he will honor a god of fortresses, a god unknown to his ancestors. He will honor with gold and silver, with precious stones and costly gifts. Arrogance. He will attack the mightiest fortresses with the help of a foreign god, and he will greatly honor those who acknowledge him. If you're on Team Antiochus, you can expect there's going to be worldly blessing. There's going to be gifts. There's going to be rewards. He will make them rulers over many people, and he will distribute land at a price. At the time of the end, the king of the south will engage him in battle, and the king of the north will storm out against him with chariots and cavalry and a great fleet of ships. He will invade many countries and sweep through them like a flood. That's success. He will invade the beautiful land. That's Israel. Many countries will fall, but Edom, Moab, and the leaders of Ammon will be delivered from his hand. His success is not universal. He will extend his power over many countries. Egypt will not escape. He will gain control of the treasuries of gold and silver and all the riches of Egypt, with the Libyans and the Cushites in submission, but reports from the east and the north will alarm him, and he will set out in a great rage to destroy and annihilate many. He will pitch his royal tents between the seas at the beautiful mountain, beautiful holy mountain, and yet he will come to his end, and no one will help him. If you're here a few weeks ago, you remember this description. In the midst of this battle, Antiochus developed some kind of an intestinal illness. The descriptions of it are pretty horrific, and it weakened him so much that he slumped over while his chariot was going at full speed, and he fell out of the chariot and broke apparently almost every bone in his body, and he died. And the Jewish historians were quick to go, yep, there it is. That wasn't a coincidence. That wasn't an accident. That was God rebuking arrogance. That was destruction that comes inevitably. Success leads to arrogance, arrogance to destruction. That's what happened, and I think they were right. That is what happened. Because that's the pattern we see over and over again. Like, you see it there, right? Over and over and over again, success leads to arrogance, arrogance to destruction. And at a certain point, you're like, okay, God, I got it. He's like, no, one more time. Success leads to arrogance, arrogance. Okay, I get it. I don't think you do. Success leads to arrogance. Okay, God, really, I do get it. And you go, okay, God, why are you saying this? Oh, why do we have such a repetitive passage? Why do you keep hammering that over? And because God is basically saying, because you don't got it. You don't get it. Because you keep making the same mistakes over and over again. There's something in human nature that can't seem to learn this lesson, that God gives success, and yet we misinterpret success, and it leads to our arrogance, And that arrogance inevitably leads to destruction. This is an incredible danger, and every one of us faces it on a regular basis. Success is seductive. It's not bad. Success is not evil. Success is not inherently wrong. God gives success, but it is dangerous. Because unless we're very careful, success will seduce us into a place that we would never have imagined we would go at the beginning of walking that road. It operates in two different ways. We've seen them in this passage. On the one hand, our success, when we experience success ourselves, it can seduce us into arrogance and foolishness. We have some experience of success, and I just encourage you right now to think, like, where do I have success in my life? You know, maybe it's at work. Maybe it's in a ministry. Maybe it's in the political arena. Maybe it's in your family. Maybe, you know, maybe people say to you, hey, well, your kids are really turning out well. You must be a pretty good dad. And you're like, yeah, I must be. Right? And you forget the role that mom had in it. And the genetic role or whatever, or the grandparents' role. I mean, just, you know, the tendency to go, yeah, you know, maybe that is me, right? And see, what then happens is that arrogance leads to foolishness. We go, yeah, I really do have something. People need to listen to me, you know, and if people question me, then, you know, who are they? I'm successful. And so, you know, then we stop being open to input and advice and correction, all those things. See, our success tempts us into arrogance and foolishness. And every one of you has success in some area of life. And that success can be seductive. So how do we deal with it? Well, fortunately, it actually has a pretty simple solution. The armor that protects us against that seductive danger of our own success is service. It's just asking the question. See, the best armor against the seductive power of our success is asking, how can our success honor God and bless others? It's, how can I serve? How can I turn the success that I have into a platform that gives me the opportunity to give glory to God and to do good for other people? So where I have success, how can I turn that into something that glorifies God and blesses others? That's the corrective against it. Now, there's another side to it, and that is there's another side to the seductive power of success, and that is if it's somebody else's success, others' success can seduce us into compromise. Into those little steps along the way. And we go, yeah, this is not really on the straight and narrow, but it's not that big a deal. And honestly, it looks like they're going to be able to reward me in a little bit, or I don't want to be on their bad side, so I need to do whatever I need to do to be a team player. And what happens is, step by step, we find ourselves compromising our principles, our morals. We end up getting off the path. We get on a train that's going to derail. And we don't want to be there when it happens. Here's the thing. In all of this, in all this political intrigue and battles and wars and rises and falls and success and arrogance, there's one really clear truth that God wants you to hear today. And it's just this. That we thrive when we refuse to let worldly success seduce us. We thrive when we refuse to be seduced by worldly success, whether it's our success or somebody else's. That's the only path to thriving. So three questions for you. Question number one, where has success distorted my view of myself? Where have you experienced success? You know, maybe it's in your family, maybe it's at work, it's in a ministry, it's in the political arena, it's in sports, it's in academics. Where have you experienced success? And where has that begun to distort your view of yourself? And the second question is, what steps do I need to do to correct that distortion? How do I need to serve? How do I need to turn the success that I have into a platform to glorify God and to serve others? That's your best corrective. How does God want you to use your success to glorify Him and to serve others? And then question number three, where am I tempted to compromise to support someone else who is successful? I think we all face this danger on a regular basis. Where are you tempted to make those compromises? Interestingly, they're not always moral issues. Sometimes it's a temptation to compromise just to not be true to who God's made you to be. I experienced this just recently. I went away a couple weeks ago, and I spent a week planning and praying for the 2019 preaching calendar. And the first day, I said, you know what I think might be helpful? I'm going to take a look at some other really successful churches and see how they're preaching. And by the way, successful for me is I wanted to see churches that are doing a great job of engaging people and helping them become like Jesus and join Jesus on his mission in the world. That's my definition of success. So I looked down at a church I respect in Arizona, Sun Valley, and I said, you know, what do their preaching series look like? And I went, well, maybe I should kind of preach like they're doing. And worked on that for a while. And I was like, well, I respect Life Church out in Oklahoma. Let me see how that pastor's preaching. So maybe I could do some sermons like he's doing. And I was like, well, that's not working. How about, there's North Coast, Larry Osborne out in San Diego. He's a mentor of mine. I was like, I'm gonna listen to him and some of his sermons and go, I'm going to preach like him. And I spent the entire first day of this week and I had nothing. I was so frustrated. I was like, I keep going down roads, like, but I don't think I can. And it wasn't until that evening late at night where I heard the Holy Spirit speak to me and say, hey, stop trying to be like them. Just be who I made you to be. And I woke up the next morning and I went, you know what? Those are successful churches. They're good churches, but I'm not wired like they are, and I'm not going to try to be like them. I'm just going to be who God's called me to be. And it all came together. 2019 is going to be a great year. I'm excited about it. But you see, what was happening was I was being seduced by success. And it wasn't arrogance there. It wasn't bad success. And what I was being kind of led into doing wasn't necessarily wrong. It just wasn't what God called me to be. And if I'd continued to walk that road, I would have missed out on a lot of the blessings that God had in store for me along the way of doing what he's called me to do. And so honestly, it may not be a temptation to do something immoral. Sometimes it may just be a temptation to get behind somebody who's successful and in so doing not to be what God has called you to be. Don't be seduced. We thrive as God's people when we refuse to be seduced by worldly success. Would you pray with me? Jesus, thank you for your grace and your mercy. We confess to you that worldly success is seductive for us. We confess to you the arrogance that comes when we experience success and we begin to take our eyes off of you and we begin to take our eyes off of others and we stop asking the question of how our success can glorify you and do good for others. And we confess that, we ask for your forgiveness, and we receive it gratefully. Turn our hearts to you and to serving. We confess, Lord, that the success of others often tempts us away from what you've called us to be, sometimes making significant compromises, and we ask for your forgiveness. We receive it gratefully. Lord, help us to fix our eyes upon you, to be lockstep with you, and have eyes for nothing else. In Jesus' name, amen.